And Radio Derby is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your dramaturgically genial host, John Derbyshire, here with some notes and reflections on the passing Charivari. We're deep into the silly season here, news-wise, listeners. The president's out of the country. The Congress critters are fidgeting and checking their airline schedules. Your neighbour's at the beach, where he might run into a state governor or two. And your kids are serving scoops at the local ice cream parlour, unless the owner brought in his third cousin from Bangladesh on an H-2B visa to do the job. Stuff's happening, though. Stuff's always happening somewhere. Let's start by following our president on his travels to Europe. The G20 summit ended in Hamburg last Saturday, attended by our president and other worthies. That's one of those headlines that when you see it in a news outlet, you feel your eyes glazing over and you pass right on to something with a bit more flavour to it. What is the G20 anyway? What were they summiting about? I didn't know. I had to look it up. Okay, the 20 in G20 is 20 countries with big economies. Precisely 19 countries and the European Union, although France, Germany, Italy and Britain are also included in the 19, so I guess they're represented twice over. The point of the thing is global financial stability. It started up after the global financial ructions of the late 1990s. The summiting is the main thing they do, far as I can gather. Each summit is a two-day affair. This year's was last Friday and Saturday in Hamburg. Last year's was in China. Next year's looks like Argentina. They have a website, g20.org, and a slogan, Shaping an Interconnected World. And probably a t-shirt and a coffee mug you can buy, I don't know. Sure, it still doesn't get the juices flowing. There just isn't any way to make global financial management interesting. You can't deny it's important, though. So Radio Derb is doing a public service here by explaining it. You're welcome. The newsiest thing about this year's summit was the Antifa demonstrations against the show. Several tens of thousands of people showed up to protest the G20 summit, and a big subset of them were Antifa types, anarchists and other extreme left types who hate capitalism, especially hate the USA, and especially hate our president. Cars were torched, stores were looted, Molotov cocktails were thrown. 20,000 police were deployed. 20,000. They used baton charges and water cannon against the Antifa. More than 400 cops were injured. There were 200 arrests. Watching this and reading about it, I thought how out of kilter everything is and what a bizarro world our mainstream media present to us. If you were the proverbial Martian, just arrived on Earth and getting up to speed by reading the New York Times and watching CNN or the BBC, you would suppose that the main threat to public order in the West would come from the right, from Trump supporters, from Richard Spencer and his legions, from sinister, subversive outfits like American Renaissance and websites like VDare.com spitting hate. Where Europe is concerned, you'd learn that the main threat is from neo-Nazi insurgents like Marine Le Pen, or Germany's AfD party, or Geert Wilders in Holland, or Nigel Farage and his skinheads trying to get control of Britain's borders back in British hands. In fact, all those people and parties I just mentioned are genteel, well-behaved and reasonable. As our own Peter Bremelow says, we brush our teeth. It's the antifas that are breaking windows, torching cars and throwing bricks at the police. Then, when you think about it some more from an alt-right point of view, it gets even weirder. The big issue in Europe, we alt-rightists tell you, is the ongoing invasion from Africa and the Middle East. If Europeans are going to take to the streets and throw Molotov cocktails, that should be their target. That's the existential threat. The threat to Europe's future. The future that these millennials will have to live in. But that's not what the protesters are protesting. Their target is capitalism? Say what? We're coming up to the 100th anniversary of Lenin overthrowing capitalism in Russia. How'd that work out? Sometimes the world just doesn't make sense. The best takeaway from all this mayhem was a comment by the indefatigable tweeter David Burge, a.k.a. Iowa Hawk. Tweet, nothing says anti-fascist like guys dressed in black uniforms smashing windows and starting fires in Germany. End tweet. Nice one, David. For further evidence that the world of public affairs has veered off the path of reason into some kind of mass neurosis, there has been yet another outbreak of hysteria in the US media, this time over Donald Trump Jr. meeting with a Russian lawyer in last year's campaign. I'm just going to pause before proceeding to renew my call to President Trump to issue an open invitation to the Russian ambassador to sit in on all cabinet meetings. Russia is not a hostile power. We have no differences of interest with Russia. Having Ambassador Kislyak sit in on cabinet meetings would have no effect on policy, either ours or theirs. And it would cause our mainstream media reporters and pundits to hurl themselves from high windows, which I think would be a positive thing for the country. I say do it, Mr. President. Lance the boil. To the main story here. Well, what actually is the main story? An aide to one of the candidates, hoping to hear some dirt on the opposition, agreed to meet a foreigner claiming possession of such dirt. How many times does that happen in the average political campaign? Less than 100? I doubt it. Less than 1,000? Yeah, maybe. Confirmation here from sci-fi writer Jerry Purnell, an old acquaintance of mine. I'll just quote from Jerry's blog, July 12th. Jerry's reminiscing here about his time as a campaign research director for Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty in the 1969 mayoral campaign against Tom Bradley. Quote, when I was a campaign manager for Mayor Yorty, I received countless offers of information for sale about the mayor's opponent, former LAPD Lieutenant Bradley. I ignored most of them. One or two were intriguing enough that I accepted meetings with the offerer. On at least one occasion, the offer was through a third party, just as in this situation. In that particular instance, I was offered a number of unsubstantiated rumours which I could have someone run down, mostly of crime victims unhappy with Bradley's police performance. Worth noting, as it happened, but I think I paid $20 for copies of the documents, none of which proved useful. Another time I did pay about $50 to a private investigator for documents relating to some investments Bradley had made. But after inspecting them, I could not see any use for them. Although no criminal acts were involved in any of this, I never informed the mayor or campaign director Salvatore about any of these meetings. Why would I? It was just another part of the campaign. Any campaign manager offered information damaging to the opponent has damn good reason to look into the offer, although chances are good that it will come to nothing. Doing so is not levying war against the United States. And as to giving aid and comfort to his enemies, who is the enemy? I was not aware that we were at war with Russia, or ever had been. You can't give aid and comfort to an enemy you don't have, and taking a meeting in the Trump Tower in hopes of receiving information rumoured to be damaging to a political opponent is certainly not levying war against anyone. End quote. Thanks, Jerry. It's instructive to hear some plain talk about retail politics. There must be thousands of Americans who've been involved in political campaigns as researchers or advisors, as Jerry was, who could tell similar stories. Does anyone in the mainstream media want to hear those stories, though? Not now. Not here. Not here in the United States of Hysteria. Of all of Africa's 54 nations, only one is a member of the G20. That would be South Africa. Although Guinea and Senegal were guest participants at this year's summit. South Africa's an interesting study. For race realists, it's also a disconcerting one. When the blacks took over 23 years ago, we all assumed the country would quickly collapse into economic destitution and tribal warfare, with the white people of South Africa counted as one of the tribes. The joke going around at the time was, question, what's the difference between South Africa and Zimbabwe? Answer, about 5 years. Well, that was 23 years ago. South Africa's still up and running, under black-run government all this time. Some humility is called for here among race realists. Sure, South Africa has its problems, as all countries have. They have 27% unemployment, with widespread, serious poverty, including a big, poverty-stricken white underclass. Levels of corruption are, well, African. The crime rate is tremendous. South Africa's homicide rate is in the low to middle 30s per 100,000. That puts South Africa in the world's top 10, up there with Jamaica, Honduras and Guatemala, although not in quite the same league as St. Louis, Baltimore and Detroit, all of which have broken 50 per 100,000. A lot of the problems are first worldish, though. South Africa actually has the ultimate status symbol among first world national vexations. It has an immigration problem. The country is doing so well, by African standards that is, that it's plagued by illegal aliens from other African countries. There are frequent black-on-black anti-immigration riots. There was a nasty one earlier this year. From the New York Times report, February 24th, quote, "The latest anti-immigrant sentiments were set off in a neighbourhood south of Johannesburg called Rosettenville, where residents burned down a dozen houses that they said were being used by Nigerians as drug dens and brothels." End quote. Reading South African news outlets, it's surprising how many immigration stories there are. Random headline from this week, quote, "Crackdown halves number of foreigners with temporary residence permits." For a further claim to first world status, South Africa also has declining fertility, now just above replacement level. The nation's politics is quite sane by African standards. Given the current levels of hysteria in Washington, D.C., it's even tempting to say by American standards. But let's not over-egg the pudding here. True, it's a de facto one-party state, with the ANC, the African National Congress, holding power all 23 of these years. The ANC has quite distinct right and left wings, though, economically speaking, a pro-business wing and a pro-labour wing, who bicker constantly. There are significant opposition parties that did well in last year's municipal elections. One of them won control of Pretoria, which is one of South Africa's three capital cities. In parenthesis here, I just note that, looking up South Africa, the place has three capital cities, one for each constitutional branch. One for the legislature, one for the executive, and one for the judiciary. Pretoria is the executive capital. This seems to me a very good idea that could be usefully adopted by the USA. Why do we have all three branches located in Washington, D.C.? End parenthesis. So, hey, we could just as well be talking about Denmark here. Well, not quite. South Africa adopted the crony capitalist economic model. Well-paid, do-nothing government jobs are dominated by blacks, while the white and Asian, which mostly means Indian, business classes are left alone to make money. It's not a bad model. Malaysia's made it work for coming up to 50 years now. South Africa has its own particular issues, though. The issues spelled out in Ilana Mercer's 2011 book, Into the Cannibal's Pot. Fertility may be down towards replacement, but, as any demography buff will tell you, that still leaves a huge bulge from the previous higher rates to work its way through the age cohorts. Millions of young black South African adults are jobless. They are rallying to Julius Malema's new Economic Freedom Fighters Party, the EFF, which is Castroist in economics and fiercely anti-white. The ruling ANC is itself becoming more anti-white, to protect its left flank against the EFF. At an ANC party conference last week, the most hotly debated issue was whether white assets should be expropriated with or without compensation. Nobody seemed to think that white assets should not be expropriated. So, while race realists should admit they were too pessimistic back in 1994, I, for one, am not about to eat crow. As a model of multiracial harmony, South Africa will likely soon lose the little luster it had. 4 years ago, here at VDare.com, I quoted that quip about South Africa being 5 years ahead of Zimbabwe and said it should be filed under the heading True but Premature, like video phones. I stand by that judgment. White South Africans, get out of there. Last week I mentioned Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo, who'd been paroled from his 11-year jail sentence on account of having terminal liver cancer. Well, Liu died on Thursday in a hospital under police guard. He was a patriot and a hero. The treatment of him by his own government just reinforces the backwardness of that government that I spoke about last week. Politically, China is a Bronze Age despotism, masquerading as a modern managerial state. No, it's not our government's business. Nation to nation, we have to get on as well as we can with the gangsters in Peking. I am no neocon. I agree with the American president who said that we should be the well-wishers of liberty everywhere, but the champion and vindicator only of our own. And I'll allow that I am more vexed by China's political backwardness than the average citizen need be. It's my country in law. I've been involved with China, one way and another, for most of my adult life. There's an emotional connection. And, of course, I understand that we need to cooperate with China on a lot of stuff for our own interests. On North Korea, on trade, on finance, on intellectual property rights. Sure, I want our leaders to act in our national interests. All that said, it was dismaying to see our president praising Chinese dictator Xi Jinping so effusively while Liu Xiaobo's corpse was still warm. This was Thursday evening in Paris at a joint presser with the new French president Emmanuel Macron. An American journalist, I don't know which one, asked President Trump, quote, "What do you personally think about Mr. Xi Jinping?" Here's what our president said, edited quote. "Well, he's a friend of mine. I have great respect for him. We've gotten to know each other very well. A great leader. He's a very talented man. I think he's a very good man. He loves China, I can tell you. He loves China. He wants to do what's right for China. We've asked him for some assistance with respect to North Korea. Probably he could do a little bit more, but we'll find out. We're now working on some trade deals. He's been very nice. He's let, as you know, beef go back in, certain financing go back in, credit card financing and various other things go back in at my request, which is a great thing for our farmers. A lot of good things are happening, but we're going to be working on some very major trade components. But President Xi is a terrific guy. I like being with him a lot, and he's a very special person. End quote. Did you have to lay it on so thick, Mr. President? Couldn't we get the results we want, and perhaps a little more respect, by keeping Xi Jinping and his leg breakers at a polite distance? Xi Jinping loves China? He wants to do what's right for China? Liu Xiaobo loved China too. He also wanted to do what's right for China. And his notion of what's right is a lot closer to our own nation's ideals than is Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. Xi Jinping's a very special person? No, he's not. He's a cookie-cutter commie apparatchik who rose on his father's influence, never stood in a popular election for anything, and is now busily engaged shoveling his nation's wealth into a Swiss bank account. The Chinese Communist Party is full of these creeps. She isn't special. Again, I understand that when practicing international diplomacy, a politician is not upon oath. Still, he's not required to gush. He especially should not gush over the tormentor and persecutor of brave patriots just hours after one of the bravest of those patriots has died. For shame, Mr. President. A couple of years ago, when I upgraded my laptop to Windows 10, I was intrigued to learn that this operating system will sign you in by face recognition. You don't need to remember a password or give it a fingerprint. You just show it your face. You do need something called a RealSense camera, which will set you back $75, or the equivalent built into your laptop. But that's worth it for some neat technology. Face recognition has been creeping up on us for some years now, and it's really good. By some accounts, gadgets can now recognize faces better than we can. This is another depth charge going off under Moravec's paradox. Things that only a tiny proportion of high-level human geniuses can do, like winning international chess competitions, are not that hard to program into machines. On the other hand, things that even the dumbest human beings can do, like face recognition, are really hard to computerize. That's Moravec's paradox. Well, Moravec's paradox is holed below the waterline and sinking fast. For the science geek, there are always two aspects to topics like this. One, getting gadgets to do what our brains do. And two, figuring out how our brains do it. If you've cracked number two, number one's a breeze. But you can accomplish number one without mastering number two, as the chess playing case illustrates. Getting to real artificial intelligence depends heavily on progress in number two, though. Current face recognition technology is more one than two. We don't really understand how the brain does it. This is some of the most difficult and challenging work in science. We're still a long way from understanding how the brain does all that it does, but there is steady forward progress. Artificial general intelligence, that is, getting machines to do all the things that our brains do, is somewhere in our future. I doubt I shall live to see it, but my kids likely will, and my grandkids surely will, if civilization is still around. For keeping up with this stuff, I depend on a handful of websites, with Steve Shue's InfoProc blog up near the top. Steve just recently posted on a result out of Caltech, where some biologists have figured out how face recognition works in the brains of monkeys. It's cool stuff, and along the way it debunks a story that's been going around for some years in what you might call folk neuroscience. The story of the Jennifer Aniston neuron. A neuron is a brain cell. The story, which came up about 12 years ago, was that one single neuron responded to a picture of that lady. Quote from Scientific American, October 2005. Quote, in one patient, a single neuron responded to 7 different photographs of actor Jennifer Aniston, while it practically ignored the 80 other images of animals, buildings, famous or non-famous people that were also presented. Similar results occurred in another patient with a neuron specific for actor Halle Berry. The neuron responded not only to photographs, but also to a drawing and an image of her name. What is more, even when Berry was costumed as the masked Catwoman, if the patient knew it was Berry, the neuron still fired. End quote. Well, that got out into the popular culture. You've probably had it quoted to you at a dinner party or in a bar. Well, it ain't so. I always thought there was something fishy about it. As one of Steve's commenters said, after a night of heavy drinking, a few of your neurons may die. But has anyone ever heard of a case where a person subsequently couldn't recognise a celebrity? End quote. Just so. From the social point of view, as always, this is a case of science depositing something on our doorstep and leaving it up to us to decide what to do with it. Really good, super fast facial recognition is neat stuff for us techno geeks, but it can also be another blow against privacy. Liberty's younger brother. For good or for ill, that's up to us and to our wise, prudent, incorruptible legislators. Oh boy. Here's a footnote to that. When I mentioned this topic to Peter Brimelow, he said, that could seriously reduce attendance at alt-right gatherings. What Peter means is, a lot of people who show up at, for example, an American Renaissance conference would rather their employers not know they are doing so. Enemies of the alt-right, knowing this, might use face recognition to make sure their employers did know. Possibly. That is sure not a factor in this year's AMREN conference, though. The event is totally sold out. Let's just keep our shoulders to the Overton window and keep pushing. George Orwell's novel 1984 has been adapted for the Broadway stage. You can get a ticket for as little as $35. I just knew, when I first heard about this, I just knew that progressives would all be swooning over the play as relevant to our times. The phrase our times, referring in the narrow media-hooked imagination of the average progressive, referring to the last news cycle or two, as shaped by cult Marx outlets. Sure enough, they were coming out of the woodwork to tell us how relevant and contemporary Orwell's 1949 novel is. Moaned the New York Times reviewer, quote, "The production may be arriving on Broadway at a ripe, perhaps even overripe, moment," end quote. A video commercial for the show flashed images of President Trump, Sean Spicer and James Comey. So relevant. We languish in a country that shows many of the traits of a proto-fascist state, lamented the reviewer at Slate.com. The darkest depths of infantile narcissism were plumbed by the Charlie Rose show on July 11th. Charlie himself struck the keynote for this festival of ignorance with his opening description of Orwell's novel.
The book is seen as a seminal work arguing against authoritarianism and totalitarian regimes.
Charlie, Charlie, the difference between authoritarian and totalitarian is in Political Science 101. Try not to use words if you don't know what they mean. But while Charlie may not know his Pinochet from his Lenin, or his Lee Kuan Yew from his Mao Tse-tung, he looked positively professorial by comparison with his guests. These were the three principal actors in the Broadway production, the ones playing Winston Smith, Julia, and O'Brien. To call these actors airheads would be an insult to air. You can't even call them progressives. They're too dim and shallow even to hold something as facile as 2017 progressivism in their pretty heads. The Brits have an expression I like when discussing these light as air... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm insulting air again. These light as a vacuum showbiz types. The expression is lovies. That's the informal term of address that they use to each other. Lovey. Sentence for practice. "Why, Rodney, dear boy, hello, how are you? I saw you on the telly the other night in that police drama thing. Marvellous performance, lovey." So, there was Charlie Rose with three loveys, talking about 1984 and its relevance. Sample. This is the O'Brien actor speaking.
"It feeds into the great paranoia that we all are experiencing now about who can we trust and who's on whose side."
Or try this extended sample. You might want to pause the podcast and take a stiff drink first. The first speaker here is the O'Brien guy again, with Charlie Rose prompting. Later, Winston Smith and Julia weigh in.
"It's a very good story to tell right now."
"Because?"
"I mean, I know the obvious, but tell me."
"Well, I think because it could happen."
You think we're in a society and a government that's sliding towards authoritarianism, or...
"I think when we have people on the news talk about alternative facts and..."
Kellyanne Conway.
"Kellyanne Conway. Orwell writes, words matter, facts matter. So when Comey says words matter..."
James Comey.
"James Comey, it's very close. Mm-hmm. We are there."
"Because when you lose truth, you lose almost everything.
You lose the ability to have an argument. The whole point of taking words away and diminishing language is so that people can't have constructive conversations that can create idealistic evolution. Like that is the deep, deep danger. Is the moment you don't know what is real, how can I tell you what to think.
I think you don't even know where you are if you don't have truth.
There's also the pervasive paranoia, the anxiety that society takes on that allows for real the loss of all of our values. I mean, what surveillance has done to us and what we're willing to sacrifice in the name of security is a big part of it too. Xenophobia, a real just distrust for our fellow man. It's something that has always been true about the play, but now strikes me every night as being very upsetting.
That is so dumb, it is, as the physicists say, not even wrong. What we're willing to sacrifice in the name of security? Why should we have to sacrifice anything in the name of security? Oh, right, because we allowed unassimilable foreigners to pour into our country. Yet, if the local cult Marx organiser calls up Julia to tell her there's a demo against immigration restriction, she'll be out there with her placard, marching. And see that little Freudian slip there from Winston? The moment you don't know what is real, how can I tell you what to think? Who gave you the right to tell me what to think, Pinhead? As for you lose the ability to have an argument, well, I'm happy to have an argument any time. I'd have been happy to have an argument at Williams College last year, but the college president banned me. There is nothing progressives want less than to have an argument. It's like their calls to have a national conversation about this or that. Translation: shut up and listen while I tell you what to think. And look at how narrow and transient their base of understanding is. They can tell you all about what James Comey said, or Kellyanne Conway, or Sean Spicer. If you're going to draw parallels with totalitarianism, though, you need to know more than last week's news. A grasp of 20th century history would help. Could anyone in that studio name two other members of Lenin's first Politburo? I'd be very surprised. The world of 1984 was one in which nations had been abolished, swallowed up into three vast slave empires. Britain had become Airstrip 1, a mere region within Oceania, with no longer any control over its own destiny. So, where did the loveys on Charlie Rose stand on Brexit? And Orwell's deepest, most enduring insight was into the way totalitarians weaponize language, twist and alter it for their own purposes. If we go looking for this tendency in our own society, we find it mainly on the progressive left, among the people who call dissent from progressive orthodoxy hate, who call illegal aliens undocumented immigrants, who call the desire not to hear one's race endlessly insulted and belittled supremacy. These are the people for whom delinquent young blacks are teens. An Arab terrorist is a Michigan man. And mass amnesty for foreign scofflaws is comprehensive immigration reform. It's not the progressives who have shown real understanding of Orwell's newspeak vocabulary and its purpose. It's we here on the alt-right. Crime stop. Good thinkful. Double plus ungood, ministry of truth. If you want to see these words used in a pointed or ironic way, an alt-right website is your best bet. We understand crime think. We're constantly being accused of it. We understand crime stop. We see people around us practicing it all the time. And what, after all, was the model for Oceania? For the rectified language, the manipulated history, the torture chambers and the disappearances, the 2 minutes hate, the fear and suspicion of your own neighbours, your own family members. What was the model for all that? It was not the easygoing social democracy of Clement Attlee's Britain, nor the bumptious argumentative USA of Harry Truman's administration. It was Stalin's Soviet Union, which progressives of the time could find nothing wrong with, which indeed they swooned over, and whose horrors their children and grandchildren, the progressives of today, have flushed down the memory hole. That's an Orwell reference, Charlie. Although, if it were still around, they'd like it just as much as Grandpa liked the original. The current mayor of New York, a progressive's progressive, took his honeymoon in Fidel Castro's Cuba. And here they still are, the progressive lovies, pampered, primped and perfumed on our TV screens. Not minding Stalin at all. Hey, they never heard of him. But finding Donald Trump, quote, very upsetting. Old Joe Stalin's long gone, and Mao, and Ho, and Pol Pot, and Castro too. But the lovies are still with us, always with us. There's another Orwell reference coming up here, Charlie. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a lovey's Gucci loafer stamping on a human face forever. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. We finally have a result in Mongolia's presidential election. I know my listeners will be pleased to hear. Businessman Khaltmaa Batulga won with 50.6% of the vote over his opponent, Mii Gombo Enkhbold of the ruling Mongolian People's Party. I wouldn't mention this but for the facts that, number one, Mr. Batulga is described as a populist by the New York Times, thus adding another notch on the walking stick of the worldwide populist revival. And number two, the Times also tells us he is a former martial arts champion. Perhaps he could put on a charity bout with his neighbour, Vladimir Putin. And number three, I think it's neat to have any news at all out of Mongolia, where it seems like nothing much has happened since the 13th century. What's that? You want to hear the Mongolian national anthem? All right, just a snippet. Item. We all know how easily lefties slip into reductio ad Hitlerum. That is, how easily they fall back on comparing their political opponents to you-know-who. Here is one of the loopier instances of that tendency. Addressing the annual conference of her party last fall, British Prime Minister Theresa May, in reference to the Brexit vote of a few months earlier, said that people who believe they are a citizen of the world are, quote, a citizen of nowhere. Well, a Member of Parliament named Vince Cable from the tiny Liberal Democrat Party, think tree huggers and cat ladies, took exception to that early this month by saying, quote, "I thought that particular phrase was quite evil. It could have been taken out of Mein Kampf." End quote. To grasp the full silliness of Mr. Cable's remark, you need to know that Theresa May belongs to the ineffectual, arm-waving, chocolate fudge wing of her party, and has spent her career tiptoeing around all the important issues of the day for fear of giving offence. The term conservative could have been tailor-made for her. As has been wisely said by our Steve Saylor, I think, in the future, everybody will be Hitler for 15 minutes. Even meek, useless, apologetic Theresa May. Isn't it way past time that lefties found a new boogeyman to compare their opponents to? Why not Genghis Khan? It would please the Mongols. They're proud of old GK. Ah, shut up. Item, get ready for the latest terrorist threat in Europe, the Cornish Republican Army. Cornwall is the southwestern peninsula of England. It has a lovely climate, by English standards. It gets the full benefit of the Gulf Stream, and it's popular for vacations. People from England proper have been buying up houses down there, vexing the locals, who are a funny lot, a species of Celt, somewhat akin to the Welsh. They used to have their own language. It died out in the 18th century, but there's been something of a revival, and there are now several hundred speakers of Cornish. If your surname begins with tree, poll, or pen, you are likely of Cornish ancestry. Fatla Genis. That's Cornish for how you doing. Well, the vexation over those vacationing English carpetbaggers has turned nasty. The CRA has claimed responsibility for setting fire to a restaurant, and now they are talking about suicide bombings. I don't know, I have trouble taking the Cornish threat seriously. It sounds too much like a Monty Python sketch, especially since I learned the Cornish four. My hovercraft is full of eels. Lune a silly ye or scath bargesi. I think I'll just stick with worrying about Muslims. That's it for this week, listeners. Thank you for listening, and please note the care with which I addressed you as listeners. I always used to sign off to you as ladies and gentlemen, but that phrase now dwells under a cloud as being insufficiently gender neutral. The London Daily Telegraph reports that the subway authority in that city has ceased to use ladies and gentlemen in its platform announcements. This follows a campaign by sexually eccentric groups, supported, of course, by London's Muslim supremacist mayor, Sadiq Khan. Quote from him, "So far as I can tell, not intended to be ironic." TfL is the transit authority. Quote, "TfL serves a vibrant, diverse and multicultural city, and provision of an inclusive transport service is at the heart of TfL's purpose." End quote. Vibrant, diverse, multicultural, inclusive. George Orwell, call your office. Having somehow squinched a Cornwall item in there, here's a song about the place. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
As I walk home on a summer night, when stars in heaven are shining bright, far away from the footlights glare, into the sweet and scented air of a quaint old Cornish town. Born from afar in a gentle breeze, joining the murmur of summer seas, distant tones of an old world dance, played by the village band perchance, on the Cormyr came floating down. I thought I could hear the curious tone of the cornet, clarinet, big trombone, fiddle, cello, big bass drum, bassoon, flute, and euphonium. Far away as in a trance, I heard the sound of the floral dance. And soon I heard it bustling and prancing, and then I saw the whole village was dancing, in and out of the houses they came, old folk, young folk, all the same, and that quaint old Cornish town. Every boy took a girl by the waist and hurried her off in tremendous haste. Whether they knew one another, I care not. Whether they cared at all, I know not. But they kissed as they danced along. And there was the band with the curious tone of the cornet, clarinet, and big trombone, fiddle, cello, big bass drum, bassoon, flute, and euphonium. Each one making the most of his chance, all together in the floral dance.